Please be advised that the views and opinions expressed by Richard Martin of LATAM Investments, LLC, are entirely his own and do not necessarily represent those of the company, its affiliates, or its officers. Investments made on the basis of Mr. Martin's comments are unsolicited by the company and are at the sole risk and prejudice of the listener or investor.
Everybody, this is Richard Martin with Richard Martin's Wake Up Call coming to you from Miami and relayed to you by PRN in New York. And it is Monday, April the 20th, and we are going to discuss why all this is happening today. What happened to the mortgages, to the banks, to the large retailers, to retirement savings, to stock prices, to the availability of credit? How could so many errors have coincided? Well, we're going to discuss Tom Woods today, who just came out with a blockbuster book, Meltdown. I'm not sure if I recommended this to you or not. But the answers are all here. All the information that you could need to understand what is happening and what to do about it is truly to be found in this epic account. It's billed as a free market response to the crisis, but actually it's more precisely an Austrian school response. I've talked about the Austrian school before, and doubtless we'll have a lot more to say about that. Tom Woods, in his book, covers the problem of housing subsidies, low interest loans, the absurdities of the boom times, and how it was inevitable that they would come to an end. He puts the fault right where it belongs, with the government and the central bank. He blasts the political establishment for taking exactly the wrong path in response. Interest rates should be raised, not lowered. Government spending should be cut, not increased. Tax should be reduced. Regulations should be cut, not expanded. The great thing about the book is that it's rooted really in serious ideas. We're not talking about some quirky investment book by a media talking head. Professor Woods is steeped in the ideas of Mises, Hayek, and Rothbard, and he never misses a chance to explain. The book is really a fantastic weapon in the intellectual battle that is taking place right now. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to play you some excerpts from an extraordinary talk that he gave on Book TV this weekend. I think you'll see for yourself just exactly what kind of a wealth of knowledge this man has with which to garner the credibility to talk in the way he does. So without further ado, ladies and gentlemen, let's listen to Thomas Woods talking about his new book, Meltdown.
What I want to talk about today, of course, is the economic crisis. And I'm happy to say that thanks to my friends, some of you here, who are my favorite people in the world to be with, my book Meltdown is just entering its fifth week as a New York Times bestseller, and you guys helped make that happen. So thank you. But it's not any book per se. It's the ideas that matter. And right now, we are being forced to endure this conventional wisdom that tells us that the free market has failed, and we're all a bunch of stupid rubes for believing in the free market, and instead we need government officials to see us through this, and we need the geniuses in Washington to see us through. But this should once and for all put to rest the idea of the free market. Well, you know, I'm going to commit an atrocity if I hear that one more time. Because that's not just false. That is grotesquely false. It is so false that I wonder if everybody who utters it really believes it. I mean, I'm sure some of them really don't understand the situation well enough, and that's what they think. You know, the free market failed. That's what everybody tells me, so that must be the case. And then, of course, by the way, while everybody else is suffering, they get their offices renovated, because that's economic stimulus, you understand. If we blow our money on new carpeting, that stimulates the economy. I mean, there are people who believe this. I mean, seriously, it's like do they do voodoo, too? Do they go out and do a rain dance? I mean, I don't know why you would believe absurdities like this, but we have Nobel Prize winners who believe this stuff. So it's not just our currency that's been debased, ladies and gentlemen. It's also the Nobel Prize. All right. Let's get cracking here. Now, if I had more time, which I don't, I would say, let's go down through the list of government factors that led us to this crisis we're enduring today. But I don't have time for them all, because there are a lot. So I want to focus on the key ones. So normally I would talk about Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, and these supposedly private organizations that only an idiot thought were actually private organizations, that everybody knew would be bailed out with taxpayer money, and it turns out everybody was right about that. These organizations got special tax and regulatory breaks that were not available to other market actors, so they were able to distort the mortgage market in ways the free market would not have permitted. I would talk about the so-called Community Reinvestment Act. There's been a lot of emphasis placed on that, that got real regulatory teeth and enforcement teeth only in the 1990s that required banks, in effect, to make mortgage loans against their better judgment so as to avoid being sent into court and facing crushing discrimination suits. And, of course, in America, as you perhaps know, discrimination suits, in effect, if you're accused of discrimination, you are guilty until proven innocent. I mean, you're assumed to be guilty. You have to go in there and prove you didn't intend to discriminate. So somehow you have to open up your brain and, you know, look around in there for the proof. Like, I don't know how you're expected to do that. So instead of trying to do the impossible, banks just said, okay, we'll make loans that don't make any sense. I would talk about that, but I'm not going to talk about those factors because I think a lot of people on conservative talk radio have talked a lot about them, and they've made some excellent points. But at the same time, I think conservative talk radio and people who believe in the free market are still nevertheless getting killed in this debate because they are leaving out the most important precipitating factor in this crisis, and that is the Federal Reserve System. When people talk about the Federal Reserve System, the average person's eyes glaze over and they think, I could never possibly understand this. This is too technical. I better just leave this to the experts. No, that's the problem, folks. That was the problem. We left this to the experts. No, we need the people who actually know what they're talking about to have a say in this debate. So that's what I'm going to talk about quite a bit today. How do we get in this situation, and why is this not the fault of the free market? And to the contrary, why is this an example of government or quasi-government planning gone dramatically wrong? Well, I made a sort of, unfair little reference to Paul Krugman just there a little while ago. So let's talk about somebody who actually deserved the Nobel Prize, and that's F.A. Hayek, who won it in 1974. Now, what's significant about Hayek is not just that he was a genius, not just that he could write in several different disciplines and have something of value to say, but it's that the theory for which he won the Nobel Prize is the most relevant piece of economic knowledge for Americans to have right now. And it's called, we refer to it, as the Austrian theory of the business cycle. Now, let me just point out that when I gave a speech in Minnesota back in September at the great rally for the Republic, that was so much fun. And, you know, normally you write up your remarks and you figure, okay, this one people might clap. This one maybe they'll laugh. Well, I got to the point where I mentioned, oh, by the way, you know, more and more people are interested in Austrian business cycle theory. And 10,000 people burst into uproarious applause. And I thought, people who believe in freedom are the smartest people on earth. All right, now let's talk about this. Now, again, this sounds technical. Oh, I could never understand this. First of all, number one, you can understand it. But number two, more importantly, you have to understand it. Because right now, every quack on earth is getting on television, giving us his quack remedies for a crisis he didn't even see coming. We need to know the real truth and be able to defend it. So let's give the free market overview of this. Hayek's theory basically works as follows. The simple sort of Reader's Digest version goes like this. Hayek says, let's suppose you have a central bank like the Federal Reserve System. By the way, Hayek is against this on free market grounds. He says the Federal Reserve System is not the great stabilizer of the economy. What a load of propaganda. The Federal Reserve is the great destabilizer of the economy. And for people who will say, oh, but what about all the booms and busts before the Fed? Oh, I'll get to that. But Hayek's point was as follows. Interest rates can come down in two ways. Number one, they can come down if you and I save more. That pushes the interest rate down. Because now the banks have more to lend because we've been saving more. And so, in effect, to fudge a little bit here, the price of lending becomes lower. The other way that interest rates can come down is if the central bank just forces them down through so-called open market operations. Now, again, because of time constraints, we won't get into the technical details of that. That's both in my book, Meltdown, and also in a great many other books. The point is that the central bank, through so-called open market operations, can push the interest rate in various directions. They can push it down. So the interest rate, in other words, can come down naturally through the free market, and it can come down unnaturally through central planning, when you have your Soviet commissar in charge of money and interest rates pushing them down artificially. This was Alan Greenspan, by the way, you know, supposedly the big libertarian free marketeer, who has told us, oh, you know, there's a flaw in the free market. I guess I didn't notice it before. Yeah, why don't you look in the mirror and you'll see that flaw. Now, Hayek's point was that these two different ways that interest rates can come down have dramatically different economic consequences. If interest rates come down naturally because you and I are saving more, well, this has two very important coordinating effects that are really two sides of the same coin. The first is, if I save more now, that means I'm going to consume more in the future. I'm saving for the future. The more I save, the more oriented to the future I become. Well, that's good, because when interest rates come down, that's also the time when businessmen looking at the low interest rates say, well, now is a good time for us to do long-term investment, because the interest rate's really low, borrowing's really cheap. The longer term your investment is, the more interest rate sensitive it is. And anybody in this room who has a 30-year mortgage knows what I'm talking about. The first year you pay your 30-year mortgage, you're saying, okay, here comes my $2,500 payment, and then you realize that $2,200 of that is interest. You go, what is going on here? Well, that's because the term of the loan is so long, and so it compounds. So mortgages, for example, are very interest rate sensitive. If the interest rate comes down a little, your monthly mortgage payment can come down a lot. So businessmen tend overwhelmingly to engage in long-term investment projects oriented to the future when the interest rates come down. So those aspects of the economy that are furthest from finished consumer goods, so mining, for example, and construction, they get the biggest stimulus from this. Well, that's good, because people are going to consume in the future, and producers are getting ready to produce the goods in the future. Secondly, another useful coordinating device here is that if the interest rate comes down because we're saving more, well, when we save more, what that means is I produced a lot of stuff, but I have not gone back into the economy to pull out all the stuff, in effect, my cash, my paycheck entitles me to. I'm leaving it out there. And so when we release some of these resources, when we save, we are providing the material wherewithal to see all these new investment projects that businesses are undertaking through to completion. So again, the interest rate on the free market coordinates production across time. Now, what happens if the free market is not in the picture, and that instead the interest rate is just artificially pushed lower? Now, notice this is not the free market. The free market will still be blamed for everything that happens from this point on, but this is not the free market. When our Soviet commissar says, I think interest rates should be 1%, and he engages in policies to bring that about, that's not the free market. Well, what happens? Well, first of all, in this case, if the interest rate is brought down artificially, well, in this case, consumers have not indicated that they want to spend more in the future. They want to consume more now. They want to consume more at this moment, at the very time that investors are being enticed to invest for the future. So there's a time mismatch. So at a time when people want more of existing products, investors are misled into thinking that they should engage in long-term product development. Well, that's why we're supposed to have a free market in interest rates. We don't need a central planner of interest rates. But secondly, also, if the interest rate is artificially lower, in this case, people haven't released any additional resources. If Ben Bernanke pushes a button on a computer and does something that tends to push interest rates down, that doesn't mean that suddenly there's more lumber, suddenly there's more steel. There ain't more or nothing. Ben Bernanke doesn't have anything that he can give us. Although he owes it to us, whatever he has, it seems to me. But so therefore, investors are now going to start their new investment projects with an unchanged resource pool. They're all going to be grabbing from a pool that's smaller than they all thought it was. So they're going to find that their costs are higher than they thought, because they're all going to go try to buy the factors of production, but there are fewer factors than they thought, so the prices are going to go up. So again, discoordination introduced by interfering with the free market. And let's make no mistake, although in some ways we can accurately describe the Federal Reserve as a private institution, at the same time, we have to understand the Fed was created by an act of Congress, many of its personnel are appointed by the government, and it has the government-granted monopoly privilege to create legal tender money out of thin air. If it didn't have that government-granted monopoly privilege, it would be nothing. So this is a government-supported institution. Without that monopoly privilege, it would be nothing. So this is indirectly an example of the government intervening in the economy, and it has disastrous results. Because eventually what happens is, well, these projects can't all be completed, can they? The resources haven't been saved to complete them. So the thing has to become a bust. And so any attempt to explain why our economy goes through a boom-bust cycle where everybody's doing great, then everybody's in the toilet, then everybody's doing great, then, like, why is that? And now Karl Marx says, well, that's just the way the free market is. Okay, well, there's Karl Marx's wonderful view. I'm always glad to hear that. That's also sort of the mainstream view. Well, that's just the way capitalism is. Well, in fact, there's no particular reason that we should see this. Sure, some businesses are going to fail. You know, I mean, that's inevitable. People are not infallible forecasters of the future. Some businesses are going to fail. But why should they all simultaneously seem to suffer a downturn, all in the same direction, especially when the market weeds out people who are bad at entrepreneurship? If you are bad at anticipating consumer demand, well, you make losses, and if you're really bad at it, you go out of business. And the people who get your capital are ones who have proven in the past they're good at anticipating consumer demand. So given that the market tends to weed out people who are bad at this and reward people who have a good track record at it, why are these people suddenly all making errors in the same direction? And, you know, one of the explanations is that it's a totally psychological thing. They're just animal spirits, and just suddenly they just make bad decisions. Well, then I guess if we just develop the right drug and just give all these businessmen the right drug, that would solve that problem. I don't know why we're not researching that. Maybe it's because there are real factors that account for why we have these downturns and not just psychological ones. So, in fact, we've identified the source of the error. Why are there these major errors? Because, in effect, the interest rate is, and again, this is speaking a little bit loosely, not being allowed to tell the truth. The interest rate is one of the structure of interest rates. These are the most important figures in the whole economy. Every entrepreneur pays attention to them. Consumers pay attention to them. And if they are distorted, they lead to errors by businessmen, by investors, by consumers. It is not a free market when the interest rate is interfered with, because the collapse that we've seen is directly attributable to this interference with interest rates. And creating all this new money, the Fed has the power to create money out of thin air and lend it and buy assets with it and get it into the banking system, and that's what brings the interest rates down. But all this money created out of thin air discombobulates the economy. It sends false signals, and the result inevitably is a crash. Now, there will be some people who say, well, we created all this new money, got it into the banking system, that lowered interest rates, and that caused a lot of confusion. It's caused this bust. So the solution is more money. Let's create more money out of thin air to solve the problems created by the first batch of money created out of thin air. But the problem with that is as follows. Let's consider the example, the analogy that Ludwig von Mises gave. Mises was the great 20th century economist who is who basically knows more about economics than almost our whole economic establishment today put together. And Mises gave the example of a master builder. He said, let's have an analogy in which we compare the economy to a master builder. And the master builder is trying to build a house, but he believes he has, let's say, 20% more bricks at his disposal than he actually has. Now, he's going to start building that house. He's probably going to build a different kind of house with different dimensions than he would have built if he could have seen the economy's resource base clearly. But he's been misled. And let's assume for the sake of argument he can't buy any additional bricks. This is his full supply. Now, which is better? Is it better for him to discover this error sooner or later? Obviously, the sooner he finds it out, the sooner he can abandon this project. This is a bubble project. It's a wealth-consuming project that is going to go to waste, that is going to impoverish us, and it's going to impoverish him. He's going to waste bricks. He's going to waste labor time. He's going to waste resources. It's better for him to stop as soon as possible. If he waits to the end, well, then he's going to pretty much demolish a whole house that he can't complete. Well, anybody who says, well, the solution to our economic problems is that we just need to print more money and we need to get interest rates lower again, well, all you're doing is continuing the economy along the unsustainable trajectory on which it started. You are, in effect, it is as if you were saying to the master builder, or as if your strategy vis-a-vis the master builder was, instead of letting him know the real resource base in the economy, let's just get him drunk. Let's just liquor him up so he doesn't even notice how many bricks he has. He's just having a great old time. And then at the end, well, when reality kicks in, it's going to be pretty rough. But that, in effect, is what's going on. And all of our geniuses on TV and in the newspapers and everywhere else, they're all saying that that's just what we need. More of the same, more of the same. And, of course, with the Obama administration, it's just more of the same except worse. This is the policy we're being given. Now, let's remember now, because we've just seen an excellent example of what happens when you try to paper over a recession and you try to just print new money to just get us out of it, because that'll help. This sort of strategy that shouldn't satisfy even a bright fourth grader, well, we'll just print more of the medium of exchange. That should solve the problem of real structural difficulties in the economy. Well, so what happened was in the year 2000, we had the dot-com bust, which was another artificial boom thanks to all this phony baloney money created by the Fed. We had that downturn, but Greenspan decided that after a while he wanted to try and, you know, get things rolling again. So, you know, instead of letting the economy sort of bottom out, let all the mistaken investment that should never have been begun in the first place be cleared out so that real wealth generators could begin a real as opposed to a phony recovery, instead, well, you know, let's just, again, keep pushing interest rates lower. Like, this is some shortcut to prosperity. Why don't we just build a Federal Reserve System in Bangladesh and all their poverty will be gone, right? We just create bread out of stones. You know, wonderful. But look at what happened. The 2000-2001 recession is the only recession on record in which housing starts did not decline. So what happened was that by not letting the economy clear out, let the recession take its course. And the recession, of course, is just the economy trying to readjust after all the malinvestment, the misdirected resources caused by the Fed in the first place. So it's the Fed's boom that's the problem, not so much the recession, which is trying to clear this out so we can have a genuine recovery. What in fact happened was people drew the conclusion that, well, gee, even in a recession, housing is still robust. And so that's when we start to see these myths developing, that a house is the best investment you can make. Flipping houses is a wonderful way to make easy money. The housing prices can never go down. They took root because, in effect, Greenspan fed into this by, in effect, postponing that recession. And when you postpone it, it's like getting the home builder drunk, because when the bust unavoidably comes, it is much worse, because now all this time people have been making consumption and investment decisions that are unsustainable, that they wouldn't have made if they'd been able to see the economy clearly. And meanwhile, this is blamed on the free market? I mean, I really want to know how it's possible for a radio talk show host like Tom Hartman on Air America, who, by the way, says that who's never read a blessed word of Mises and Hayek, but who just wrote a column on the Huffington Post about how, yeah, you know, the economists who got us into this were, you know, Mises, Hayek. I mean, are you a blockhead? And I mean, and I say that not to be mean, or, you know, I don't want to get emails from people saying, you know, you're so mean to people. But sorry, I mean, the well-being of the country is at stake, and we have a guy who can't even be bothered to read three pages on people he condemns, people who would have prevented this crisis if they'd only been listened to. But instead, we were listening to the Tom Hartmans of the world, that prosperity can be created by spending it into existence, by printing it into existence. Well, that is an economic policy, an economic theory for children. We need an economic theory for grown-ups. That says that wealth and economic well-being are created not by spending per se, but by saving and producing and through entrepreneurial skill. There is no shortcut to that. Now, incidentally, without the Fed, there would have been no housing bubble. Because what would have happened is, let's say people had just become irrationally attached to the buying of houses. What would have happened? Well, that's one of the arguments. It was a mania. People just went crazy. Well, even Anna Schwartz, who's not even an Austrian, she's a monetarist, even she says, and I quote her in Meltdown, that, you know, if there isn't a Fed creating all the credit, where would all the money come from for this mania? Because let's say we all started buying houses, the price of houses would go up, and interest rates to borrow for these houses would shoot way up. And that would put an end to speculation in real estate. But instead, what happens when you're, again, when you're the Soviet commissar in charge of money and interest rates, when you're Alan Greenspan, you can just create a lot of new money out of thin air, and now the banks have a ton to lend. And so you can keep this illusion going. But it is an illusion all the same. And so just like the home builder in the example, who is a great example, by the way, that's a wonderful analogy to show how producers and investors get misled into engaging in projects that the economy's resource base can't complete. But it's also a good analogy for consumers, because during the housing boom, consumers thought they were richer than they were because their home prices were appreciating. All the experts told them this was going to keep on happening. So, heck, you know, why not borrow against it? Why not buy that fancy car? You know, why not buy a $5 cup of coffee at Starbucks? You know, heck, I'm sitting on a $500,000 house, $1 million retirement portfolio, the sky's the limit. So that home builder analogy is also useful for consumers. They were out on an unsustainable consumption binge. They wouldn't have bought all these crazy things if they had known their house is only worth half of what they thought. So everybody's being misled. And Gerald O'Driscoll, who was formerly with the Fed, who's an economist, actually said that for the Fed to be standing there after what it has done to us and say, we don't know what caused this, it's probably all you reckless speculators, or it's probably all you people leveraging up, and blah, blah, blah. It couldn't have anything to do with us. It couldn't have anything to do with the fact that we're making all this money available totally cheaply at almost no cost for you to leverage up in the first place. We won't even mention that. We'll just say that we actually are the saviors here. We're the saviors. They caused this. They caused all this miscalculation. Now, meanwhile, to make matters worse, we had, during Alan Greenspan's tenure, the phenomenon known as the Greenspan put, which investors understood to mean that, in effect, Alan Greenspan has put unofficially into place a floor beneath which asset prices will not be allowed to fall, that the monetary authority will intervene and bail you out. That's why some people called him Mr. Bailout. So the bailouts are not just like the past year or so. Well, Anthony Mueller, an economist, says, since Alan Greenspan took office in the late 80s, financial markets in the U.S. have operated under a quasi-official charter, which says that the central bank will protect its major actors from the risk of bankruptcy. Consequently, the reasoning emerged that when you succeed, you could fail, the authorities will save you anyway. And in the wake of the dot-com boom, the Times reported in 2000 that there was an increasing concern that Greenspan and his put, which was an unofficial doctrine, of course, was injecting into the economy, quote, a destructive tendency toward excessively risky investment supported by hopes that the Fed will help if things go bad. Now, the argument will be raised, but what about before the Fed? I mean, didn't we have crazy ups and downs in the economy before the Fed, and we've had nothing but sunshine and lollipops ever since? Well, okay, first of all, we did have the Great Depression after the Fed. That's kind of a big oops. That is far, far worse than anything that occurred in the 19th century. But there is a sort of twofold response to this, and I do have a section in Meltdown that deals with the ups and downs before the Fed. One of them is that Christina Romer, who's gotten much worse over the years, but she actually has a couple of important journal articles where she argues that the apparent extremities of the economic swings of the 19th century, as opposed to the apparent stability of the post-World War II period, is partly an artifact of the way the statistics are gathered. But secondly, the fact is that when you go back and look at the 19th century and you look at these booms and busts, it's the same factors. I mean, no, I will grant you, it's not a Federal Reserve system. Okay, you got me there. But everything else is there. You have national banks, the First National Bank of the United States, the Second National Bank. You have, in the panic of 1819, the panic of 1837, you have, again, a boom created by excessive money creation that, again, could not have occurred on a free market. You have the government intervening to bail out the banks, saying, oh, you don't have to pay your depositors who come asking for their deposits. And the banks know the government's going to bail them out like this, so, again, you think this might make them become a little riskier? And incidentally, let me just put in parentheses here that it's true that the Community Reinvestment Act and all these other things did require and in fact, encourage the banks to lower their standards of creditworthiness. But we should remember that the Fed and central banking throughout American history, even before there was a Fed, when they increased the money supply, we always see lending standards go out the window. I mean, it's particularly pronounced in recent years because there were so many monetary and regulatory factors putting money into the housing market. But we see this in the early 20th century. We see it in the 19th century. They're throwing money at anybody because there's so much of it. And in fact, the key point to remember here is, let's say I'm a coach of a basketball team, and let's say they change the rules and they say you're allowed to have two more people on your team. Okay, well, in order for me to get two more people on my team, I have to go back and look at people I cut before, people who wouldn't have made the cut in the past. Well, the same thing goes with all this new money the banks have on hand. They want to lend it out, and our system encourages that. So if they're going to lend it out, it's inevitable. They're going to have to lend it out to people they would have rejected in the past. So this, the very existence of the Fed, the very institutional structure we're operating under, leads to this. But in any event, all these panics of the 19th century, they all have the same pattern. There's excessive money creation leads to a phony boom, which culminates in a bust. It happens in 1819, 1837, 1857, 1873, etc. It is the same phenomenon. You would have to be asleep not to see it. And in fact, I want to quote for you what William Leggett had to say about this. Now, William Leggett is a New York editorial writer in the 1830s, a supporter of Andrew Jackson. And listen to him describing the phenomenon that he just observed in the 1830s that culminated in the panic of 1837. And incidentally, you'll notice that, thank goodness, our economy now is panic-proof because the government decided we're just not going to use the word panic anymore to describe any of these things. So that's how they get rid of it. That's what they've also done with the toxic assets. We solved that problem. There are no toxic assets. They're now legacy assets. I mean, really now. I mean, they must get a real laugh at how dumb they think we are. I don't know. But listen now. Here's a guy writing in 1837. He could be writing in 2009. And he's writing about the same phenomenon that has nothing to do with the free market. This is a guy who calls for absolute separation of bank and state to prevent this from happening again. And listen to him. He says, "What has been, whatever must be, the consequences of such a sudden and prodigious inflation of the currency? Business stimulated to the most unhealthy activity. A vast amount of overproduction in the mechanic arts. A vast amount of speculation in property of every kind and name at fictitious values. And finally, a vast and terrific crash when the treacherous and unsustainable basis crumbles beneath the stupendous fabric of credit and the structure falls to the ground, burying in its ruins thousands who exulted in the fancied security of their elevation. Men nowadays go to bed deeming themselves rich and wake in the morning to find themselves stripped of even the little they really had. They count, deluded creatures, on the continued liberality of the banks, whose persuasive entreaties seduce them into the slippery paths of speculation." And so think here of house flipping and the housing bubble. "But they have now to learn that the banks cannot help them if they would and would not if they could. They were free enough to lend when assistance was not needed, but now when it is indispensable to carry out the projects which would not have been undertaken but for the temptations they held forth, no further resources can be supplied." Okay, Paul Krugman, you listening? 1837. This guy's just a journalist. Later that year, he said, "Any person who has soberly observed the course of events for the last 3 years must have foreseen the very state of things which now exists. But yet I'm sure he had to endure people even then who said, oh, no one could have predicted this. No one could have seen this one coming. Same thing our wise leaders tell us. He says he will see that the banks have been striving with all their might, each emulating the other, to force their issues, that is their new money, into circulation. He will see they have used every art of cajolery and allurement to entice men to accept their proffered aid, that in this way they gradually excited a thirst for speculation, which they sedulously stimulated until it increased to a delirious fever, and men in the epidemic frenzy of the hour wildly rushed upon all sorts of desperate adventures. They dug canals where no commerce asked for the means of transportation. They opened roads where no travelers desired to penetrate. And they built cities where there were none to inhabit. Now, again, bizarre. I just read about this gigantic center, 64-acre thing they were building in Las Vegas. They're abandoning the whole thing. Talk about cities where there were none to inhabit. The same phenomenon. So don't tell me that, oh, you know, before we had all these problems, but now the Fed has gotten rid of them. This is exactly the problem we had then, exactly the problem we have now, and for the same reasons. Now, what I suggest to you is that this is not just a matter of, oh, we need a little more regulation. Look, that is the most irresponsible intellectual laziness imaginable, to look at this and say we need more regulation. If the institutional structure gives rise to this, encourages excessive risk, if by making credit artificially cheap, encourages excessive risk and all the excesses we've seen, you can have all the regulations you want. But eventually, we won't repeat this exact type of scenario. Congratulations. For example, we'll never have another shoe bomber. Good, because everybody's taking his shoes off at the airport now. So, yeah, we're always way ahead of last week's terrorist, and if we ever have a time warp, we'll be able to catch them. So if we have a time warp here, we can stop this one. But the point is, regulatory tinkering is and I give more detail, because there is more of an argument here, more detail in Meltdown about this, but it is the institutions that are giving rise to this. It is the money itself. And so what we see here is that we have a money that can be manipulated, can be created out of thin air, and I know that there are all these criticisms, oh, but if money were attached to gold or this or that, there are all these terrible problems, we could never have that. That caused the Great Depression, they say. Well, that's not true either, but I don't have time for that at the moment. But the point is that we get all these crazy criticisms, but as Henry Hazlitt said, Henry Hazlitt, who in saner times wrote economics editorials for the New York Times, believe it or not, the one sensible thing the Times ever did. Henry Hazlitt said that, I don't care what your technical criticisms of gold or precious metal standard or commodity money are. The fact is that it is a money that government cannot just manipulate and its central bank at its will. It cannot destroy people's savings by manipulating it. And whatever your technical criticisms are, they are utterly trivial when set next to this single merit of a sound money. Right now, of course, we have an unsound money, a money that is redeemable into nothing. It's just the way the government likes it. And so what we've seen is that artificially manipulated paper money with nothing to back it, so the central bank just create all it wants so as to give us the phony prosperity, well, what comes with that is the boom-bust cycle. Low interest rates that are the result of real, genuine saving are the foundation for real, genuine growth. Low interest rates that are a result of manipulation yield us only boom and bust, as Professor Roger Garrison says. And then, to add insult to injury, when the bust comes, well, all the major players who are caught out in it, who shouldn't have acted the way they acted, they then turn to the paper money producer and ask for a bailout, and they usually get what they ask for. Now, I ask you, is this so obviously the best conceivable system that every non-trivial alternative is to be dismissed out of hand? What we are watching is a slow-motion train wreck as we observe Washington and the Fed try to put everything back together. And in the interest of time, I'll refer people on the subject of the stimulus package. On my website, tomwoods.com, I have an article called Tooth Fairy Economics, explaining why there's no way the stimulus package can improve things. And in fact, on tomwoods.com, I also have a free chapter of Meltdown you can read if you hate it. I'll never bother you again, but if you like it, maybe you want to get it. But thank you. But I'll conclude with this so that we can keep our program more or less on schedule. Who's being held up to us as the people we should listen to? Well, first, Ben Bernanke. Isn't it funny that Ben Bernanke felt he had to go on 60 Minutes to talk about, defend the Fed and explain why everything he's doing is so urgently necessary? I mean, I don't know if that has had to happen a lot, but they're under more pressure than they've ever felt. And that's not supposed to happen because, you know, we peons aren't supposed to notice the Federal Reserve, you know, because they're doing what's best for us. They know what's best for us. How dare we peons question them? But we are starting to question them. Of course, the reporter, the journalist who's interviewing Ben Bernanke, isn't questioning him. The reporter's job is to throw him softballs over the plate. Because, as I said this morning, it is the job of the mainstream media to make our overlords look good, make them look smart, make them look indispensable, but never ask them really a challenging question. Ask them things like, what's the toughest thing about being a central banker? Come on, what kind of a free press is this? I mean, they're too ignorant even to know what question to ask. And even if they did know, they're too overawed by these bozos. Why be overawed by a guy who told us a couple years ago that his regulators had investigated the mortgage market and found that it was healthier than ever? Why should we listen to a guy who said the housing bust will be over by December 2008? Why should we have listened to Hank Paulson, who told us in early 2007 the world economy is in the best shape it's ever seen it, best shape ever? These are the people we're supposed to care about? I mean, seriously, you would want to do the exact opposite of what these people recommend. So let me say this. Instead of listening to every quack on earth who has been wrong for years, been giving us the wrong advice, who contributed to the blowing up of the largest asset bubble in the history of mankind, instead of listening to them, let's listen to people who saw it coming. And again, these aren't soothsayers. These aren't people who had crystal balls. They're people who had sound Austrian economics. Jim Grant, Jim Rogers, Peter Schiff, Ron Paul. It's not a coincidence that they saw this coming. It's because they have the correct knowledge. Why don't we listen to them? Their phones are not exactly ringing off the hook from the Obama administration. The Obama administration seems to be of the opinion that the bigger blockhead you were, the more surprised you were by the crisis, the less sensible advice you have, well, the more we want to hear you. But if you saw this coming, forget about it. So, ladies and gentlemen, let's listen to the people who not only predicted this, but who have a theory to account for how it happened and a serious proposal for how to get out of it, because, ladies and gentlemen, that would be change we can believe in. Thank you.
Right. Well, I don't know how I could possibly have provided you with 45 minutes of better information, more succinctly put, than courtesy of Thomas Woods. He seems to me a fairly new player on the scene. I wasn't familiar with him a while back, but he did write a fascinating book in the Politically Incorrect series, called The Politically Incorrect Guide to American History. And I used it largely in my 5th of January seminal talk about why my wife and I were moving to Singapore. I used a lot of factual information out of that. Thomas E. Woods, and by the way, that came to you courtesy of C-SPAN's Book TV, which I heard this yesterday, had a whole different show prepared for you, and frankly, I could not resist playing you this. I thought it was really worthy of your attention, and I hope you've enjoyed it. Certainly, I've heard it now twice, and the second time round is as instructive as the first. Stuff I missed, and certainly it's worth your while. There were, of course, questions after that that were asked, but I left those out. They were interesting, but at the same time, I thought we should call it a day at that point. So, the name of the book is Meltdown by Thomas E. Woods, Jr. Highly recommended. And if you do happen to read it and want to give me some feedback, as always, preferably over the air, please do so. I suppose I should give you my information. My name is Richard Martin. This is Richard Martin's Wake-Up Call. And if you want to contact me through the show live. You may do so on our toll-free number at 888-873-4643. Once more, 888-873-4643. We have about 10 minutes, so if anybody wants to call in with a comment, I'd love to hear from you. Alternatively, of course, as always, you may give your comments by the email system, which would require you to write to rmartin@latiminv.com, which is short for Latin American Investments, Latiminv. And again, rmartin@latiminv.com. And finally, if you would like to call me directly with your questions, concerns, etc., etc., you may do that privately by calling my direct line at 305-579-2012. Once again, 305-579-2012. All right. It goes without saying that I pretty much agree with everything he says. I couldn't find any substantial differences at all of any nature to disagree with. So I think you can pretty much place the commentators in two camps, those who agree and those who don't. I mean, it's as simple as that. Those who think that the government knows best, that the government will always come out with the solution, they are all powerful, and therefore they can always create whatever scenario they want, will clearly not agree. Those people who think that the free market should hold sway, then clearly you are in agreement with Thomas Woods and the Mises school of thought, the Austrian school of thought. Hayek, of course, is tragically no longer with us. So there we go. You may have heard of watched a segment on 60 Minutes last night, not the one about the Matador, which I thought was quite fascinating, but the one about the 401k plan. As usual, the segment was was famous for what it did not show rather than for what it did. In other words, it didn't ask any questions about the content of the 401k plans. They somehow, strangely enough, tried to give the impression that it was some kind of conspiracy to bring people down. I really didn't get that at all. I didn't know what they were talking about, but it certainly had nothing to do with the problems that 401k plans have for their adherents today. So anyway, it was another puff piece, as usual, on a very important facet of our life, and it was irritating, as always. It's really getting more and more troublesome to listen to that program, 60 Minutes, now. I don't know what they're doing or who they're supporting or why they do this, but they've lost, it seems to me, all balance, all sense of criticism, of profound criticism of the things that used to make them famous. I don't know what to make of them either. Okay, Joe from Philadelphia is on the line. Hello, Joe.
How are you doing today?
Okay, thanks.
I have a question for you. As far as reliable news media goes, because like I heard on the recording that you had just played for us, which was actually quite well, I missed hearing you, but we got some very good information. Like you said, the American media seems to lay down in awe of people of some sort of authority, in quotes, and they don't want to maybe offend people. What news outlets, maybe even European, possibly D&W, Deutsche Welles, that I watch sometimes on Sundays, is that a reliable news network, or who should we be really looking for not puff and not smoke and mirrors, but like here's the reality of it. It might be painful. It might be upsetting. It might be what we laid down and allowed to happen, and heaven forbid we say we were part of the problem for being fat and lazy and uninformed. Where should we trust?
I don't know where to start. There's so much to be said on that subject, Joe. Deutsche Welle, DW, that you mentioned, is actually very good. Curiously enough, CNBC's early morning segment, the European segment, is 1,000 times better than the CNBC that takes over at about 6 a.m., the American CNBC. I don't know why they have more pungent commentators on in Europe at the early hours of the morning. It's very difficult to know why this is. Without giving you, you know, the names of outlets which are reliable, because I don't know any, let me just try to examine a little bit why these regular news media are so hopeless and useless and biased. I think, unfortunately, there are a lot of reasons that play into this, why the editors of these media just simply nix the kind of commentary that people ought to be listening to. The most important of all, I think, Joe, and I've thought a lot about this, so, you know, this is not just off-the-cuff commentary here. These media need access to the important elements of our society, whether they're the government elements, whether they are the corporate elements, whatever they may be, in order to be credible, the news media need to be able to contact these people. Now, in terms of government, I'm sure we all know very well what happens when, for example, the White House gives a press conference. They make a list of the reporters that they are prepared to talk to, and the president, or whoever it is, simply calls upon the right people, quote unquote, to speak and to ask their questions.
Because they already know pretty much what the answers are going to be, or
and they know what the answer is going to be in advance. Of course they do.
Right,
yes,
right.
Of course. And so if you want to get a question in, you have to belong to a media amenable to the White House. Now, if you are on the other side of the fence, if you are a corporate analyst for example, one of the big wirehouses like, you know, Merrill Lynch or Prudential or whoever it may be, you need to be able to talk to the representatives of these different companies that you're analyzing. You have to be able to ask them questions, because that's what gives you credibility in the eyes of the institutional fund managers to basically get their ear and thereby get their orders when they place the orders with the big companies. I mean, all this is tied up with, you know, the industry norms of getting business from institutions. So if you ask the wrong questions or you make the wrong criticisms, the bigwigs in these companies simply won't speak to you, and you can call as often as you like till the cows come home, or you can get on their conference calls on the telephone, and you'll simply not be called upon to ask a question.
Yeah.
And you'll never get to go to the companies, and they'll never speak to you. So, you know, there's just two examples, Joe, of where it becomes almost impossible to go against the grain. And you know, there is no easy answer to this. This is the way that the society is set up. America has never been a self-critical society as a cultural concept, so that sort of doesn't help either. Was there
the same mistakes over and over again. There's no learning of a lesson.
No, I mean, the system is entrenched. I mean, there's no question about it. This is the way they live, and unfortunately, the rules of the game do change. I mean, government has become more pervasive over time. It has taken on a much, much larger and more all-embracing role in our lives. And the press have simply got to go along with it. There's simply no way. You see, if you're an alternative press, that's fine. But the trouble there is you don't get financing. So if you don't get financing and you can't keep up a regular barrage of commentary, then how are you going to survive? I mean, here I am, a lone voice. Well, I'm on Progressive Radio Network. I don't get paid to do this. I do this because I truly get a sense of well-being from giving my brand of information to the likes of you and my other listeners. But I couldn't do this full-time. I couldn't make a living at it. So, I mean, basically, that there are problems inherent in trying to get the truth out. And that's why I think, in a general sense, Joe, if you're really trying to get to the truth, you're much better off going to foreign sources, you know, to get information from people who have no bias, no axe to grind. You know, they're going to be interesting going to be interested. If you can find out, you know, who you like, then, but by all means, you know, for example, Ambrose Evans Pritchard, who writes for the Daily Telegraph of Great Britain, he's excellent, and I always try to read what he writes, and I put out the best of what he writes onto my distribution list, my email distribution list for my clients, and I think he's good. Now, I don't agree with everything he says, but he is clearly trying to understand the essence of what the problem is.
Right.
In a general sense, I think the British are a little bit more critical than the Americans, not much, a tiny bit. There was a famous speech given by a member of the European Parliament in very, very strong criticism of the British Prime Minister the other day. I played it on the show here. That kind of thing you'd never hear that in the United States, in Congress, for example. It's a sort of conspiracy of silence, if the word conspiracy is useful, if you want to call it that. Yeah,
that's
I suppose
good.
So.
I hear you.
All right. Yeah. Well, there you go, Joe.
Could, one more time, that fellow's name from the Daily Telegraph, Ambrose what?
Ambrose Evans, that's E-V-A-N-S, hyphen Pritchard, P-R-I-T-C-H-A-R-D.
A-R-D.
And it's his last name is a double-barreled name, Evans-Pritchard, so if you go to Google it, remember that.
Okay. Very good, and thank you for being there for us.
All right. Well, it's a pleasure.
Maybe I'll see you in Singapore.
Take care. Bye.
Bye-bye.
All right. Let me just finish here, I suppose, with Steve's rant. It's entitled A Quickie. Richard, I do know that this could never occur in 1,000 years, but let's say it does. What if? All the trillions of dollars that the nitwits in Congress so kindly bestowed upon banks and businesses and just about any darn fool that extended a hand with a tin cup in it were within 3 years to pay it back. I mean, pay it all back. Richard, does anyone really think that if Congress had $3 trillion in their hands at one time, they would return it? No way. You can kiss that good money goodbye. Well, not to worry, this money will never come back, nor will our children have to pay it back. I can see that our once great nation will, within a few years, go Chapter 11. I think we are close to the bottom, but the bottom I envision is going to be a disaster, the likes of which we can't imagine. Steve Kruger. Well, Steve, thank you very, very much. Always interesting to hear from you, and I appreciate the input. All right, ladies and gentlemen, well, listen, I have enjoyed, I was going to say, speaking to you, but I really felt that today's offering was probably more beneficial to you than the usual diet of information that comes your way. So I look forward to hearing any comments that you might have to make on it or any other matter. And until Thursday at 2 p.m. Eastern Time, this is Richard Martin of Richard Martin's Wake Up Call saying bye-bye.